You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
Last night, I kept calling my wife in to see something that was happening on TV. She has an eternal sort of lackadaisical association or relationship with football. I have the opposite sort of relationship with football, a very impassioned one. Last night, if any of you saw it, I think it was honestly one of the greatest football games I've ever watched in my life. If you don't like football, it's fine. But it was Ohio State playing Penn State last night, and it was a remarkable game. In terms of back and forth, in terms of the execution, the chess game that was going on through the coordinators, the way that the players were playing, it was a magnificent game. But the reason I kept calling my wife in, although I think I called her once in to see this caught pass, more than anything, I called her in several different times, hey, you've got to come and see this, because the camera would pan back, at Penn State, Happy Valley, their stadium holds about 110,000 people. There were almost 111,000 people at this football game. Just consider that for a moment. 111,000 people. 111,000 people all decided to do the same thing very enthusiastically. Like, where else does that happen in the world except for a football game? And I guess soccer, other places. But last night, the reason I kept calling her in is occasionally Penn State, when they play a big opponent, when it's a big game, they will call for what they call a whiteout. And the call for a whiteout means that everyone in the stadium, 111,000 people all wore the same color. So not only did they show up to do the same thing enthusiastically, they all decided to wear the exact same clothes, to do the thing that we're told from junior high on you should never do, which is wear the same outfit as someone else. 111,000 people pushed against that impulse and decided to show up at one place to cheer enthusiastically for one game and to wear all the same color and to yell for about 4.5 hours. Come on, like that should shock you. It doesn't, because it happens every weekend. But it was it's an amazing thing that happens in our culture. A stunning thing. And so last night, I kept calling Jenny to come in because the camera would pan back and they showed this giant stadium filled with 111,000 people shouting and cheering and all wearing white. And they called it a whiteout. And when the sun went down, they all pulled out their phones and turned on their little flashlights. And so you had white on bright light on white on white. It was just white. And it was amazing. And it dawned on me this morning that, like, we say we're not a religious culture. We say that we're a secular culture. And yet we can get 111,000. They showed at the end of the game, Penn State lost, unfortunately, I think, 27-26. It was a heartbreaking loss. It would have been a great upset. And they're panning the crowd, and they're showing 22-year-olds expressing deep emotion in the midst of 111,000 of their peers weeping over a football game. Now, I like football, but let's just be honest. That has zero consequence. Like, it literally doesn't matter at all. I know there are Aggie fans in this room who would beg to differ, at least in terms of their games, but let's just be honest. It doesn't matter at all. Like, it's high-cost entertainment on a Saturday. Like, that's all that's going on in this game, and you're seeing 22-year-olds surrounded by their peers weeping, and we say that we're not a religious culture. What we watched this week is a kind of the different events unfolded politically. And whatever side you took, or whatever angle you took on what unfolded this week around the Supreme Court nomination and the hearing and the different people's testimonies, people's responses were not moderate. I mean, Twitter, like, was on fire. People's conversations I was having with people in coffee shops were on, like, people were not kind of arriving at kind of this moderate, nonchalant position, what was unfolding politically in our country this week. And we say that we're not a religious culture, that we're a secular culture. But we live in a time and a place when people long to worship, and they do. But one of the great insights that that the Bible offers us, and particularly the Ten Commandments, as we begin this week a series walking through each of the Ten Commandments, one of the key insights that is laid out before us in the Ten Commandments is it defines humanity as a worshiping being. Man worships. Always. Claim to be an atheist, claim to be agnostic, claim whatever religious position you want. You, at the very basic core of who you are, every single person you meet on the streets, every single person everywhere worships. You may find your hope and worship the political system. You may worship your own pleasure. You may worship your own success. You may worship kind of a traditional understanding of the family. You may worship kind of the freedom of the autonomous individual. But whatever it is, but be sure of this, you worship something. This week we begin this process of examining and looking at the law of God. But what does God say to us? And I want to open, before we actually begin to look at the specific command that's laid out for us here in this first commandment, I want us to consider together just a couple of things, because I don't know of anything that has been more misused and twisted and misunderstood than the law of God. And so before we kind of get started over the next 10 weeks and before we get started today, I want to lay out some ground rules. Is that okay? Some ground rules as to what you can and can't do with the law. So I'm telling you what you can and can't do. It's kind of a law unto itself, if you will. But I want us to begin there. I want to begin by giving some instruction and saying, hey, here's what people have tried to do with the law in the past. Don't do that. It leads to some really bad places. And here's what the law is for, what the Bible tells us the law is for. So as we begin to actually look at the details of what the law is, you don't kind of leave here with this dangerous, dangerous tool called the law and find yourself like me using a nail gun. I should never use a nail gun because I'll do something dumb with it. So the law is like a really, really big nail gun. That's a great analogy. The law is like a nail gun. If you misuse it, you'll find a nail in your hand. So don't use the law that way. My wife is shaking my head saying this isn't working. I don't care. I'm going to push through. So we're just going to keep on going. All right, so a couple of different things, three different things specifically that the law, I think the ways that the law is misused, ways that you'll be tempted over the coming weeks to misuse the law, particularly as we get into like the details, like I'm talking about stealing and killing and Sabbath, and the specific kind of rules around how we relate to one another. But even particularly this week, and it's actually insightful and incredibly insightful, important that you don't use even this law, the first commandment, in one of these three ways. One, just to kind of be really clear, the law cannot justify you. It can't save you. And this is a way that people have used the law historically. Like, if I do good enough, if I do all the things that God wants me to do, if I take the first commandment and say, I'm not going to worship idols, I'm only going to worship God, I'm only going to show up at church, and that's going to be my place of worship. If I do that well enough, then I'll stand before God. He'll look at me and say, you're righteous, you're good. The law cannot do that. And one of the things that you will find, the places that you will find yourself, the nail that you'll find kind of nailed into your arm on accident somehow, I would find a way to do it. The way that this will destroy you is you'll find yourself in one of two places. Utterly despairing, because you'll find in the law a ladder you cannot climb. All of them, take any of them, and drill down deep and kind of get to the essence of what this law is commanding, and you'll find something you can't do. And so if you use it as a way to try to justify yourself, to try to hold yourself up as being worthy of God's love or worthy of God's approval, what you'll find instead is this self-condemnation, this inability to find yourself approved before God. Or you'll find yourself kind of self-deceived. Like, You'll go to a commandment like, thou shalt not commit adultery. And you'll say, hey, I've done that. I've never had sex with anyone but my wife. And you'll think that by doing that, by doing kind of your interpretation of what the law says, that somehow you are good enough and you're better than those people or better than those people. And you'll find yourself in this incredible place of either one, despairing because you find yourself falling off the first rung of the ladder week after week after week after week, or on the other side of it, thinking yourself truly righteous, truly embodying all that God wants for the world. And you'll find yourself just a guy that nobody wants to be around. So one, don't use the law to justify yourself. Two, and this might be a little bit more controversial, but a little less kind of self-evident. Don't use the law to try to liberate yourself from sin. All of us find ourselves kind of locked in to this, often, this cycle of sin, whether it's pride or whether it's lust or whether it's whatever the thing is, a lack of integrity, but whatever the thing is that kind of you find yourself trapped in. If you try to come to the law of God, come to the commands of God merely as the means by which kind of like, not just necessarily justifying yourself before God, but somehow using it as a way of liberating yourself from that cycle, you'll be sorely disappointed. But Paul tells us again and again in the New Testament, Galatians is built on the idea that the law cannot justify you. And then in Romans, Paul tells us, shockingly, scandalously, the law lacks power. In other words, what we need to kind of liberate us from sin, what we need to liberate us from these cycles of addiction and disobedience and brokenness and sin, what we need is not just someone to throw us a rope that we can grab hold of and pull ourselves up with, which is how many people try to use the law. If you use the law that way, you will never be liberated. The law is not there to give us power. It's not there to kind of justify us. And the last thing, and this is particularly, you see this over and over in the New Testament, the law became a way for, in the early church, for Jewish Christians to somehow separate themselves socially from Gentile Christians. The law is not a tool to be used to kind of separate ourselves from other people. And there's a bunch of different roads to do this, but what you see in the New Testament is one of the fundamental problems that begins to unfold in the New Testament. And really, to be honest with you, most of the New Testament is written to address this central issue. Is the law becomes a tool to kind of distinguish ourselves, to separate ourselves from other people. Becomes a way of being more righteous, a way of being really God's people, a way of being the holy ones, a way of being the ones who obey God, love God, trust God, and everyone else is out. If you find yourself using the law of God that way, any particular law of God that way, you'll find yourself standing accused by most of the New Testament. So, don't use the law to justify yourself. Don't use the law thinking or relying upon the law as somehow, as though it has the power to kind of liberate you from sin and sanctify you. And third, don't use the law as kind of a tool to set up fences and divide yourself from other people. So what is the law actually for? I think first and foremost, what we discover in the law of God, what we're going to see again and again and again, is it exposes our need for God's grace. It exposes our need for rescue, that we cannot save ourselves. Not only can we not justify ourselves before God, but we can't even free ourselves from the things that ensnare us day to day, week to week. Attitudes, behaviors, words that we speak, lusts that we have. In the end, the law comes and exposes those things for what they are. Things that we can't save ourselves from. And so the law pushes us to cry out to God and say, save me. Who will liberate me? To use the language of Paul, who will actually set me free from this body of death? Second, we're going to see in the law, and I've been shocked by this, stunned by this, the more I've kind of dove in and studied over the last few weeks to get ready for the next 10 weeks, is like how comprehensive the law is. I remember as a child, kind of we had to memorize the Ten Commandments for Sunday school. We had to and recite it to our parents, and then we got to recite them from the church. It was just an important thing that we kind of had to do as kids. We had to recite the Ten Commandments, and they always felt like, hey, if this is all God really wants from us, like don't steal. Okay, I won't steal things. Don't commit adultery. Don't kill somebody. That's hard, but we're going to try really hard. And so if this is all God wants me, I remember as a child thinking like, this is like really simple. And there's so much more to life, so many more things to have to wrestle with or figure out what God wants for us in. And yet here, the law of God comes, and it feels simple, and it feels like it's just up here. But the more you begin to dive into it, the more you begin to, particularly with the eyes of Jesus and the help of Jesus, as he begins to point out and teach us, how do we actually hear the law of God coming? But what you begin to see is it actually is deeply comprehensive. What God's given us in the law is not just kind of this surface level, kind of list of check boxes to kind of check off and make sure you're doing, if you do these 10 things and you're doing okay, and the rest of your life live however you want. What we're actually going to find, what I've found, and again, is that the law actually speaks to, gives shape to, commands us about the rest of life. In other words, there's no remainder left after the law begins to divide up our life. My kids are, one of my children is in the midst of doing division or learning how to do division, but it's not long division yet, long division is just soothing to the soul at times. This is just like remainder. So I can't even do the problem right now, but I'm really bad at math, but I'm really good at it. Like when the law begins to divide up our life, when it begins to examine our lives, there's no remainder at the end of it. There's no like part of our life that then is left over and left untouched by the way that God has commanded us to live and the way that God begins to design and shape our lives through the law. And the last thing before we jump into Jeremiah 2 is the law comes, and actually we hear this kind of repeated phrase in the New Testament that Jesus Christ is the end, the goal of and the fulfillment of the law. But we're going to see from a myriad of different angles over the next few weeks how the law actually reveals to us the glory and the beauty and the goodness of Jesus. It pushes us to cry out for salvation. It gives shape to kind of our understanding of how God intends all of life to be shaped. But here's what I find precious. It actually reveals to us the character, the goodness, the beauty of Jesus himself. So that's where we're going to go. If you have a Bible, I would love it if you would turn with me to Jeremiah chapter 2. And we're going to use Jeremiah chapter 2 to begin to think about and to begin to wrestle with this first great commandment, that you shall have no other gods before me. That God begins there. He begins with this announcement that the law of God at its core is this command to never worship anyone but him. And so I want us to read this text, and then we're going to kind of ease our way into trying to wrestle with this command not to worship anything but God. I'm going to begin Jeremiah chapter 2, starting in verse 11, reading through the end of verse 13. Has a nation changed its gods, even though they are no gods? But my people have changed their glory for that which does not profit. Be appalled, O heavens, at this. Be shocked, be utterly desolate, declares the Lord. For my people have committed two evils. They've forsaken me, the fountain of living waters, and hewed out cisterns for themselves, broken cisterns that can hold no water. This is the word of the Lord. So Jeremiah is writing to the people of Israel who have turned away from worshiping God. Actually, Jeremiah is, if you dive deeper into Jeremiah, he's going to be continue to stand before the leaders of Israel and indict them. And at the core of his indictment of who they are, of what they've done, when they've done a whole lot of things. They've practiced sexual immorality. They've corrupted themselves with the other nations. They've forsaken God himself and refused to just trust upon God. They've kind of compromised themselves politically and socially and sexually, every way imaginable. But at the core of God's complaint that he raises through Jeremiah is this. You've worshiped false gods. But rather than trusting in me, rather than trusting and worshiping the God of the universe, rather than obeying me and relying upon me and trusting my promises to you, you've turned and begun to worship other gods. But intrinsic, fundamental to that indictment of God's people is this fundamental presupposition. God's saying, I am your God. That I'm the God who's claimed you. I'm the God who's redeemed you and rescued you. That I'm the God who's saved you and called you to myself. I mean, he uses over and over again in the book of Jeremiah this marriage metaphor, this idea that God and Israel are married, that they're in covenant together, that they belong to one another. The foundational to kind of hearing God's complaints, foundational to hearing God's commands even, is this proclamation of who God is in relationship to his people. In the book of Exodus, as God begins to lay out the Ten Commandments, it's fascinating. A number of commentators have pointed this out. A number of theologians have pointed this out. You'll find this everywhere you see the law expounded in any of the reformers. Did you hear where Ryan began or said that God began? In Exodus 20, he doesn't begin by giving commands. No, the very first thing that God says to Israel before he commands them to do anything is this. He says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. At the beginning of the law is the gospel. God doesn't command anything of his people before he reminds them and tells them, I'm the God who's rescued you. I'm the God who's redeemed you. And any hearing of what God commands, if it doesn't begin there, can't help but misuse the law in the ways that we've already talked about. And so before he commands us not to worship idols, he tells us and reminds us of who he is and what he's done. I am the Lord your God, who's rescued you, who's redeemed you, who's brought you out of slavery. And then, and only then, in the light of that, you shall have no other gods before me. So the law begins with the gospel. It begins with an announcement of God's love for us, God's work for us, the way that God has fought for us. And then it begins with this command, you shall worship no other gods. Now, a number of different scholars throughout history have noted the brilliance of how God begins and ends the law. The law is bookended by two commands, which both Calvin, Luther, numerous other theologians, everyone has pointed out that these two commands actually give shape to and define everything in the middle. And that in reality, like Luther himself said, that you cannot break any of the commands of God without first breaking the first command. That if I steal, foundational to my stealing is that I'm worshiping or trusting in or relying upon some god other than God. If I commit adultery, if I envy, if I want what my neighbor has, then foundational to breaking that law more than anything is I'm breaking this law, this first law, and that I'm worshiping something or relying upon something or entrusting myself to something other than the God who is there. And so before we go anywhere else, I want to consider kind of the brilliance of at God's analysis and understanding of the human soul. He begins with worship because the Bible defines us as worshiping beings. We will worship something. and who you worship, what you trust in, that there's two things you need to know about this. Whatever it is that you worship will demand some sacrifice. But whatever it is that you worship, you will build your life around liturgies, rhythms, practices that orient you towards that thing that you worship. Let me give an illustration. First, this idea that you will build rhythms around that which you worship, that things that you repeat over and over and over again. I really like watching footballs on Saturdays. I would even say that come February, I have friends who are really into the, like they're totally satisfied by the shift from football to basketball. I'm not. I just feel myself in February feeling like, I mean, I'll watch basketball, but it's kind of a loss. Just a net loss in the goodness of the world that happens between January and February. But what happens basically from August through the end of particularly college football season for me is it becomes a source of tension between my wife and I every single August, is that I will build my Saturdays around the football games I want to see. The whole schedule. Nothing gets to invade that. Nothing. I don't care. Did a pipe break? Shut off the water. Did whatever the thing is. Like this is the rhythm that we're going to have. I'm going to get up. We're going to turn on game day. I'm going to sit in this little spot on the couch. I'm going to drink my coffee. And I'm going to watch game day. And then we're going to transition to, if there's an interesting game, we're going to watch the early interesting game. If there's a late game, there's always an interesting late game, we're going to watch the interesting late game. And that's the schedule. And anything, yesterday I told my wife, as we were in the midst of our quiet time on our patio, and I was getting ready to go in and watch game day, hey, here's the window of time for our family today. That if we're going to do something, it needs to happen between basically 12:30, 1-ish, when the early game ended, and 5:30, and we need to be done at 5:30. Like, so there's our window. The liturgy of our day is prayer. Just gonna pray for the games later, and then game day, and then this game, which I wanted to watch, and then particularly the 5:30 game with Ohio State, Penn State. And if that got disinterested in that, we'd flip over to the Notre Dame, Stanford game, back and forth. And then once that was over, then, you know, there'd be a window of time we could do some other things as well as a family. But this is the window. This is how the liturgy works. Now, I hope not. College football is an idol for me. But here's something I really love. Maybe something that hasn't quite attained the level of worship. I don't find my hope in it. I don't find my trust in it. But I do take great pleasure in it. And something that's even not quite a God, I still build a liturgy. I still build a rhythm around it. One of the ways to kind of find out, what does your heart truly love? What does your heart truly worship? Where is it that you're finding your hope? What do you build liturgies around in your life? Rhythms that are unbreakable. In fact, when they get pushed on, you find yourself responding in irrational ways, angry ways, defensive ways. Can you think of those things? Maybe they're around alcohol. Maybe they're around work. Maybe they're around your kids. Because that's the other thing. Anything can be an idol. And most, well, actually, 100% of the time, it's something good that gets twisted, that gets held up as something you love more than God himself, something that you look to as your salvation, as your hope, as your meaning, as your identity, whatever it may be. Jeremiah's description of idolatry in this text, and it hits me so hard. Look at what my people have done They've committed two sins, two evils. They've forsaken me, and they've hewn for themselves. They've made for themselves cisterns, broken cisterns that can't hold water. Do you know what a cistern is? Anybody have a cistern in their backyard? Probably not. You don't use a cistern for your water. It's good because there's plumbing and stuff. So what a cistern was is Israel lived in a pretty arid place, and so water would either like be a lot of it or there'd be none of it. And so when you live in a place like that, prior to the delivery of water through pipes to your home, you would build, if you didn't have a well and if you didn't have a fountain, a spring of living water near your home, you would dig out for yourself a large hole. And so it's fascinating that Jeremiah actually uses this illustration, and later in Jeremiah, he gets thrown into a cistern, which I think is irony. But a cistern, basically, you'd have kind of a hole, and then the hole goes down, and then the hole turns into a giant kind of cavern-like place. And the idea was that it would rain. Water from the rain would come, and you don't know when you're going to get rain again. Might be months. That rain would kind of flow into the cistern. The cistern would fill up with water, and now you have this nice, it's actually pretty gross, water that's sitting kind of underground in a cistern. And when you need water 3 weeks from now because you're all out and you don't have a well and you don't have a spring, you can go to the cistern, stick a bucket in it, pull out some water, and drink your nice, clean, cisterny water. And so what God says is, my people have turned away from me, a fountain of living water. And the idea there behind living I think it has two fundamental meanings. One, living means it's water that just gives life. It actually makes you alive. And two, it's flowing water. The most valuable land to have in an arid place is if you happen to get the piece of land that has a stream of water running through it, right? Because now you have living water, water that's moving. It's not sitting kind of getting nasty in a cistern. No, it is water that is constantly flowing through your land. It is living water. It's moving water. It's clean water. You can get in it. You can swim in it. You can drink it. It's just there, and it's flowing, and it's crisp, and it's clean. Versus a cistern, which has water in it, which is just pretty nasty. I spent one week in Morocco, and we went several days. We went on a lengthy hike into the wilderness, kind of visit these different villages. We were there with some Christian missionaries who were trying to build some relationships with these villages in the hopes that they could go there, preach the gospel, and see people come to know Jesus. But as we were going on this hike, it's a longer, way funnier story than I'm going to tell right now, but essentially I had a very small bottle of water. It was very hot. I'm a large man, so I need extra water. And so we're walking for like days into what amounts to a mountainous desert. And we would come up on basically over and over and over again cisterns where you would dip a bucket in, fill up your water bottle, and it was so gross. And I'd be so thirsty, and they had this little, never mind. But the next to last day of this hike, all we'd been drinking was basically cistern water the entire time we're on this hike. Occasionally there'd be a well, but basically it was just cistern water. And the very last day, the missionary was talking about how excited he was because we were going to get to finally this spring. This spring of living water, this water that was actually coming out of the ground, it was fresh water and coming out. And I remember, it was the greatest water I've ever drank in my life. Like, and it was mostly because I'd only had really bad water and was dehydrated beyond all manner of what I should have been. But we came up on this, this fountain of living water, this spring of living water coming out of the ground. And you didn't have to clean it. You didn't have to do all the stuff that you had to do at all the cisterns. You could just literally just dip your water bottle in it, and you could just drink it. And it was just delightful and delicious. And this is the contrast that God sets up as he begins to talk about the nature of idolatry. But what he says is that all of humanity, rather than going to that fountain of living water, that spring of living water, we've done two things. One, we've turned away from it. What Jeremiah describes, what God describes as forsaking it, forgetting it. I'm saying, I don't want that. And instead, we've turned and we've dug out our own cisterns. But then he says this about those cisterns. They can't hold Water. I'm just shocked by the brilliance of God sometimes. What the Ten Commandments lay out for us is that the fundamental issue with your life, the fundamental issue in our society, the fundamental issue in the world, if you want to nail it down to one thing, here it is. We've turned away from the fountain of living waters. The one that we were all created to find life in, to find our definitions of morality in, the one that we were made to worship and find delight in, the one who is the definition of beauty and goodness and truth, the one that we're to go to again and again and again, because that's the thing with fountains of living water. You don't just go to them once. You find your life there. You build your city there. You build your entire foundation for life and everything that you are, business, morality, beauty, the arts, everything, you build around that system. That fountain of living waters to drink there. But rather than us building a society, rather than building our lives, our families, our marriages, our relationships, around coming back to that well to drink again and again and again, we've turned away from it, we've forsaken it, and instead we've tried to come up with other ways to find water. And they can't hold water. And what you see politically, what you see in business, what you see everywhere, you see things unraveling in our world. Every place in your own life, your own family, your own relationships, it is at its root a failure to drink here, but to try to find in other things, things like success, things like pleasure, things like personal autonomy. Things like your idealized version of marriage or your idealized version of the family. Whatever that thing is, seeking in those things that which you were only meant to find in God. And please don't misunderstand me. When you drink there, it will utterly transform your understanding of family. When you drink there, it will utterly transform your understanding of what it means to be married and to raise children. When you drink here, it will shape and define how you engage with business and with work and success. When you drink here, it frees you to enjoy and give thanks to God for all of his pleasing and pleasurable gifts. When you drink here, it literally touches everything. It begins to shape how you define what is right and wrong. It defines how you understand success. It defines how you understand what you're supposed to do with your money. It defines how you're supposed to relate to people that you don't like or disagree with. It changes literally every single facet of your life. But here at the beginning of the law is the command to drink here. Here only. This is where the law begins. You shall have no other gods before me. But again, that word doesn't just hang in this room. God doesn't just come and say, worship me, worship me, worship me, worship me. He begins by saying, I am the Lord your God, the God who brought you out of Egypt, the God who has redeemed you and rescued you. You see, just as we close, the law begins with the gospel. The command to come and drink, it isn't just a command out there thrown out, say, hey, drink here, don't drink there. God's not coming to us like Coke comes to us and says, don't drink Pepsi, drink Coke instead. No, God comes to us and says, come to me and drink because I'm the source of your life. I'm the one who has saved you. I'm the one who has redeemed you. I am your covenant God. Oh, we come to him and drink First and foremost, because when we didn't, God sent his son to rescue us. Those broken cisterns leave us dying. They leave us without hope in the world. They leave us with the world unraveling. They leave us with lives that are unraveling. And yet God does not sit passively by, but rather he pursues us. Next week we're gonna see that God grounds his command to not make false images of him. He grounds his command by saying, "I am a jealous God." And there's all kinds of different, there's at least two different kinds of jealousy. There's a kind of jealousy that actually erodes and destroys trust. But there's also a kind of jealousy, the jealousy that's commanded of husbands for their wives, the kind of jealousy that God holds out and defines and describes himself with, that is a jealousy that proactively pursues the object of that jealousy. I want to end with a story. A few years ago, we had friends who it became exposed. The husband discovered that his wife had been having a long-standing affair, and it was devastating. And when it was found out, she, because of shame, because of guilt, because of I don't know what to do, she began to pack her bags. He was coming home to talk to her and began packing her bags and threw them on the car and got in the car, was getting to leave. And she later told us all she had no idea where she was going to go. She just had to leave, run from all of it. And this man, he kind of sees what's happening as he pulls up. He jumps out of his car, he runs, and he lays himself on the front of the hood of this car. And he says, "I love you, I love you, I love you. I'm not going anywhere, I love you. I love you. I love you. I'm not going anywhere." Here is a husband jealous for his wife. Here is a God who has watched us drink other cisterns, chase after other gods, whore ourselves out to find meaning, to find identity, to find hope anywhere but in him. And he could have sat passively by and watched us go. But instead he comes and he dies on the cross, declaring to us, "I love you, I love you, I love you. I'm not going anywhere. Come to me and drink. Come home to me and drink." This is where the law begins. Not with mere commands, but with a covenant-keeping God who has rescued us in Jesus. A jealous God, a faithful God, a redeeming God. Let's pray.